Warning, you are about to listen to a life-changing session of the Think and Grow Rich Global Mastermind podcast. Any mind-blowing income, health, happiness, and otherwise earth-shattering testimonials of total transformation are not meant to serve as a guarantee of what will happen in your life as you continue to plug into this podcast. Rather, they're meant to give you an idea of what's possible. Bear in mind, results are not guaranteed, they are earned. Be forewarned, common side effects of listening to this podcast may include increased mental alertness, random and unexplained feelings of joy, a crystal clear sense of purpose in life, spontaneous outbursts of laughter, obscene amounts of new and exciting monetary deposits, and other ridiculously awesome symptoms of living a purpose-filled life. Please enjoy the show.
Actually, I just woke up one day and decided I didn't want my life to feel like that anymore. So I changed it, just like that. What's up, moneymakers? This is Mahara Tucker in Atlanta, Georgia, and you're on the Think and Grow Rich call. Our talented founder, Mr. Paul Hutchings, will be with us shortly. But for now, tell us your name and where you're calling in from.
Lionel from Detroit.
Larry and Wendy, McKinney, Texas.
Aloha from Arkansas. This is Elliot.
Good morning, Kathy Early from Idaho, ready to make some changes.
Good morning, Mahara and family. This is Lionel Gibber from Detroit, Michigan.
Good morning, it's Lori from Winnetka.
Good morning, it's Veronica from New York.
Hello, hello.
Morning, Mahara. I'm from Jacksonville.
Do we know Mahara?
She likes all the sugar. Wish I wasn't so proud of that.
Good morning, Lisa Scott, New Jersey.
Lisa.
Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
I don't know Sarah, so it's Veronica.
Hey, Veronica.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to hear what goes on today.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Morning, Mahara. This is Danny from Oregon.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Great.
Yay, Mahara. Hey, Mahara. Hey, what's going on? There, Mahara.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. It's Amy in Las Vegas.
Hey, beautiful Amy.
Morning, Amy.
Nicole from North Carolina.
Good morning, Rick from California.
Mr. Rick Martin, welcome to the call.
Good morning, Troy from the Big D, Dallas.
Steady.
Good morning in Dallas.
What's up, kiddos? Hey.
Who is that?
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
You guys got this thing weighed down so much I can't hardly move it.
Move it.
Move it.
Good morning, Mahara. Elizabeth from Virginia.
Hey, Elizabeth. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. You all sound excited.
What's happening, Chick?
I'm having a great morning.
What's happening, baby girl?
Morning, Mahara. It's Charity from Bronx, New York. How you doing this
morning,
wonderful
buddy.
Wednesday?
Good morning.
Hey, Charity. I'm doing great this morning.
Great.
Good morning, Squirt. My mini me.
Press 5-6 after you say your name.
My little mini me.
Good morning. This is Linda from Dallas, Texas.
What are you doing with my chair?
Hey, Linda. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, little mini me. Move your phone. Very windy.
Can you turn my chair down?
Jack from Bemidji, Minnesota.
Can I turn everything up? Don't break it. Yeah.
Who else is stepping out this morning?
Good morning, it's Joe from Long Island.
Good morning, all right, kiddos.
Janet from Bemidji, Minnesota.
Danny from Oregon.
I take action acting from St. Louis.
Hey, Danny, good morning.
Morning.
Aisha from D.C.
Hey, Aisha. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor. Let me call it Boston. Morning from Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
Good morning in Ohio. Welcome.
Joe Dollar, good morning.
Good morning, Lisa from New Jersey.
Lisa, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Deborah from Philadelphia, good morning.
Hey, Deborah, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It is wonderful Wednesday, August 26, 2015. And, you know, I love when I pick up the phone, dial into this call, and the first thing I hear is a woohoo! Oh, isn't that great? I just love it. I love you guys. I love being here. I love what we're going to learn today. I'm excited, guys. I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about the present. I'm excited about how hopefully all of us on this call are getting better. I believe it. I believe that as we continue to plug into this information, as we continue to think, mastermind, hear good ideas, and take action in our lives, I believe we are getting better. And I wanted to share something with you guys this morning real quick before we do our definite purpose and our self-confidence formula and then jump into our regularly scheduled study, which, by the way, is Chapter 3 of Think and Grow Rich, 1937 edition. You can grab this book on our website if you're new to our call. It's at growrichaudios.com in the free download section. But here's what I wanted to share with you guys. I was reading last night in The Greatest Salesman in the World by Og Mandino, and he had a line in there that I thought was really powerful. He said, "I will form good habits and become their slave. I will form good habits and become their slave." And if you think about yesterday's call, I was sharing a little bit about Dr. Napoleon Hill, how later on in his life, after he formulated the first 16 laws of success, and then after he wrote the book Think and Grow Rich, he added a couple of laws that he felt that he had discovered, universal laws, principles of success, and one of them was the law of cosmic habit force. Right? Saying the same thing as Og Mandino, forming good habits and becoming their slaves, this law of cosmic habit force. Well, about a week and a half ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to my friend Brandon, and I mentioned to you guys, he was reading this book called The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. And the idea in The Compound Effect, as I understand it from my friend Brandon, is this idea that it's not the things we do, it's the things we do daily that add up over time that make up our lives. It's not the big, grand actions that we take every once in a while. It's like Anthony Robbins was talking about this morning as I was on the treadmill. He says, it's not like, you know, you get overweight and then you're like, I'm going to run 10 miles. And then you go run 10 miles. And then you stay out of the gym for another few months. It's not those big exertions of energy that matter. It's getting in the gym every day and running a couple of miles or walking a couple of miles or lifting some weights or whatever it is that you do. It's doing it every day consistently over time. And Darren Hardy's talking about this compound effect about how when you form good habits and you engage in them over time, great things happen in your life. And so I was thinking about those ideas, and I was thinking about this idea that it takes 21 days to form a habit. And then I was thinking about my life and how a lot of times I'll be like, you know, I'm going to do this and that and the other. I'm going to do all these things, and I fail at all of them. I don't know if you guys have ever had that experience. It's sort of like if you were going to learn how to juggle and you just grabbed 10 balls and started throwing them all up in the air, what would happen? You'd probably drop them all. But if you started with one and you just went left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, left hand, right hand, then you got that down. So you picked up another one and then you started to rotate the two and you're getting that down and you get that down to where you're comfortable and it's habitualized. And then you add a third one. You can see how it would be easier to compound, to grow. And so I took these ideas and I was like, all right, Paul, why don't you do this? Why don't you focus on one habit for 21 days and see what you can do? See if you can make that one good thing a habit. And so I started with one little thing, and I was like, I'm going to make a video every day for 21 days. And I think today I'm on like day 16 or 17. I'm keeping track of my journal. Well, day two comes along, and I'm like, all right, I got this. All right, let me try a few other things. And so I added like, two or three things. And it wasn't like the third day before I had dropped the second and the third, and I was only doing the one. So I kept doing the one. But then after a little while, I was like, I'm going to add on another. I'm going to add on another. So here I am about 2 weeks in, and I've been adding little things as I've been going along. So like my videos. So today is day 16 of my videos. Today I'm on day 8 of drinking 8 glasses of water. I'm on day 6 of keeping a journal every day. I'm on day four of running 2 miles every day. And what I'm doing is I'm just adding little things over time, focusing on the one, but then picking up others as I'm going along, and then I'm keeping track in my journal every night as to what good habits I've done and how many, what day I'm on in my journey. And here is the fascinating thing that I am noticing. I was talking about this to my wife last night. I said, you guys might laugh at me, but I'm sitting on the couch with my wife, Corinne, and I said, honey, did you know your husband is getting better? And she's the wonderful woman that she is. She says, really? Tell me about it, Paul. What are you doing that you're getting better? And so I just started to tell her about some of these little things that I'm working on. I said, what's interesting is here's what I've noticed, is as I'm focusing on these little habits that I'm working on, and as I'm keeping track in my journal every night, as Jim Rohn told me to do for years, but for whatever reason, I've been on and off, on and off, on and off with the journal. But I made a video a few days ago about how it seems like it's important to keep a journal. One of the big reasons is so that we can become self-aware of what's happening in our lives. And I had an experience about a week ago, where I was writing in my journal at night, and I was thinking about my day, and I'd noticed a couple of spots in my day where I had raised my voice a little bit higher than I was comfortable with my children. And I thought about that, and I was like, I do not want to be like that. I want to control my temper. I do not want to have anger inside of me. And so I wrote that down in my journal, and I was self-aware that that had happened. And I thought about, if I had not written in my journal that night, I would not have noticed that, probably. I would not have thought about it. I would not have paid attention to it. So my point is, as I've been writing in my journal every night, it's just a simple act, and I've noticed that sometimes I'll write more, but it just on a very basic level, just keeping track of the 21-day habit goal that I set, just keeping track of that and thinking about it, here's what I've noticed is that all these other little things are popping out to me. As I go through my day, all these other little things that I could start 21-day habit goals on. And I think they would have gone unnoticed had I not been doing what I'm doing. And I think maybe I would have had a little bit less faith that I could attack them had I not been attacking the ones that I'm working on just one at a time, one at a time, one at a time, adding another one maybe when I feel like I can take another one, adding another one when I feel like maybe I can take another one. And it's just really interesting how I'm becoming self-aware, more self-aware, of all of the many things that I could improve on in my life that I might not be aware of had I not been engaging in this process. And I'm having these light bulbs. It's like, no wonder Jim Rohn said all the time, keep a journal. It's one of the most powerful tools for personal development, for personal growth. I'm now understanding on a little bit deeper of a level why maybe he said to do that, because as I do so, I'm becoming more self-aware. So I wanted to just share this little experience with you guys. And just maybe encourage you to start with something, if you're not already, start with something you feel you can handle and just focus on that for a while until you feel you got it, and then maybe pick up another and pick up another and shoot for 21-day goals. Because, again, I'm trusting the experts here. Maxwell Maltz, Psycho-Cybernetics, says 21 days to form a habit. In fact, in that book, he says, now that I'm thinking about it, he says, tie your shoes in a different way for 21 days. Pay attention to which shoe you always tie first and tie a different one and maybe swap the order of the laces. And part of the reason that I'm thinking now that he says to do this is so that you can prove to yourself that you can change and you can form new habits. So just a little experiment that I want to share with you guys that maybe you might consider applying in your lives if you're not already to see some pretty simple but profound life changes. And it's just good stuff. So I want to share that with you guys now. Let's go ahead and get into our definite purpose self-confidence formula. But before I do, I want to ask you, Think and Grow Rich practitioners, passionate, positive people all over the world, are you excited about this journey that we're on of self-mastery? Are you excited about this journey that we're on of getting better over time? Are you excited about this journey that we're on of recognizing that light that's inside of every single one of us and day by day, bit by bit, thought by thought, action by action, habit by habit, causing that light to burn brighter and brighter and brighter so that it can illuminate our own lives, so that it can illuminate the people around us, so that it can spill over into our businesses, and who knows how far the light can go. Are you excited about that? And if you are, let's go ahead and give a scream into the phone as I unmute the lines right now. Hold on. It's good stuff, isn't it? Audience participation is great, and I think that is really what makes this call what it is. In fact, I chuckle a lot because I see people expressing notes of gratitude for this call and how much it means to them, and many of the notes are all about you guys and the things you share in the mastermind portion of the call. So that's a cool thing. So anyway, who's got the definite purpose self-confidence formula ready for us? Star 6 and come on out if you'd like to lead us through that this morning. Who's going to show initiative and leadership? Who is that? I'm sorry.
Carrie,
is that right?
Yes.
Hey, good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
Go ahead, take it away.
Okay. By the first day of, I will have in my possession, which will come to me in various amounts from time to time during the interim. In exchange for this, I will give the most efficient service of which I am capable, rendering the fullest possible quantity and the best possible quality in the service of its capacity of. I believe I will have this in my possession. My faith is so strong that I now can see it before my eyes. I can touch it with my hands. I can now await and transfer to me in the time and in the proportion that I deliver the service I intend to render for it. I am awaiting a plan which to accumulate this, and I will follow that plan when it is received. Self-confidence formula. First, I know that I have the ability to achieve the object of my definite purpose in life. Therefore, I demand of myself persistent, continuous action towards its attainment. And I here and now promise to render such action. Second, I realize the dominating thoughts of my mind will eventually reproduce themselves in outward physical actions and gradually transform themselves into physical reality. Therefore, I will concentrate my mind for 30 minutes daily upon the task of thinking of the person I intend to become, thereby creating in my mind a clear mental picture of that person. Third, I know through the principle of auto-suggestion, any desire that I persistently hold in my mind will eventually seek expression through some practical means of attaining the object back of it. Therefore, I will devote 10 minutes daily to demanding of myself the development of self-confidence. Fourth, I have clearly written down a description of my definite chief aim in life, and I will never stop trying until I develop self-confidence for its attainment. Fifth, I fully realize that there's no wealth or position can long endure unless built upon truth and justice. Therefore, I will engage in no transaction which does not benefit all whom it affects. I will succeed by attracting myself to other forces I wish to use and the cooperation of other people. I will induce others to serve me because of my willingness to serve others. I will eliminate hatred, envy, jealousy, selfishness, and cynicism because by developing love for all humanity, because I know that a negative attitude towards others will never bring me success. I will cause others to believe in me because I believe in them and in myself. I will sign my name to this formula, commit it to memory, and repeat it aloud once a day with full faith that it will gradually influence my thoughts and actions so I can become a self-reliant and successful person. Woohoo, I did it!
You not only did it, Carrie, you did a fantastic job. So grateful for you. Real quick here, guys. I believe in you. Second. Hey, if you guys believe in Carrie and think she did a fantastic, phenomenal job, let's let her know as I unmute the line. All right, well, there you have it, Carrie. One of the best cheers of excitement and enthusiasm that I've heard. So great job. All right, guys, let's get to work. We are in chapter 2? Hold on here. Nope, we're in chapter 3. At the end of chapter 3, let me scan to where we're at. We are about to read. We're at the bottom of page 50 of 235 in the ebook copy. And we're about to read an astounding story, okay? So here we go. Dr. Hill says, The watchword of the future will be human happiness and contentment, and when this state of mind shall have been attained, the production will take care of itself more effectively than anything that has ever been accomplished where men did not and could not mix faith and individual interests with their labor. Because of the need for faith and cooperation in operating business and industry, it will be both interesting and profitable to analyze an event which provides an excellent understanding of the method by which industrialists and businessmen accumulate great fortunes by giving before they try to get. The event chosen for this illustration dates back to 1900, when the United States Steel Corporation was being formed. As you read this story, keep in mind these fundamental facts, and you'll understand how ideas have been converted into huge fortunes. First, the United States Steel Corporation was born in the mind of Charles M. Schwab in the form of an idea he created through his imagination. Second, he mixed faith with his idea. Third, he formulated a plan for the transformation of his idea into physical and financial reality. Fourth, he put his plan into action with his famous speech at the University Club. Fifth, he applied and followed through on his plan with persistence and backed it with firm decision until it had been fully carried out. And sixth, he prepared the way for success by a burning desire for success. And by the way, those of us who are mentoring people in our lives, I believe that one of the best things we can do as mentors is just help the people we're working with go through these six steps on their own. You know, help them formulate an idea, a desire, right? We can't give them a burning desire. They got to come up with that on their own. But we can help them identify it, and we can guide them to formulating a plan. We can encourage them to take action, and we can inspire them to continue on those plans with persistence and to back them with firm decision. Can we do that? It seems to me that maybe is a huge part of the job of a mentor, just in case we have people on the line, which I know we do. We get a lot of people in the home business profession who are mentoring people. I don't believe it's our job to do everything for the people we're working with. Really, it's very simple, right? And I'm just submitting that. I could be wrong. These are just some thoughts that I've been having. Maybe share with me in the mastermind portion of the call if you think I'm on or off on this stuff. But it seems like that's what Dr. Hill is mentoring us to do. So maybe it's a good idea to kind of pass that along. Continuing on, here, if you are one of those who have often wondered how great fortunes are accumulated, this story of the creation of the United States Steel Corporation will be enlightening. If you have any doubt that men can think and grow rich, this story should dispel that doubt. Because you can plainly see in the story of the United States Steel the application of a major portion of the 13 principles described in this book. This astounding description of the power of an idea was dramatically told by John Lowell in the New York World Telegram, with whose courtesy it is here reprinted. A pretty after-dinner speech for $1 billion. When, on the evening of December 12, 1900, some 80 of the nation's financial nobility gathered in the banquet hall of the University Club on Fifth Avenue to do honor to a young man from out of the West, not half a dozen of the guests realized they were to witness the most significant episode in American industrial history. J. Edward Simmons and Charles Stuart Smith, their hearts full of gratitude for the lavish hospitality bestowed on them by Charles M. Schwab during a recent visit to Pittsburgh, had arranged a dinner to introduce the 38-year-old steel man to Eastern Banking Society. But they didn't expect him to stampede the convention. They warned him, in fact, that the bosoms within New York's stuffed shirts would not be responsive to oratory, and that if he didn't want to bore the Stillmans and Harrimans and Vanderbilts, he had better limit himself to 15 or 20 minutes of polite vaporings and let it go at that. Even John Pierpont Morgan, sitting on the right hand of Schwab, as became his imperial dignity, intended to grace the banquet table with his presence only briefly. And so far as the press and public were concerned, the whole affair was of so little moment that no mention of it found its way into print the next day. So the two hosts and their distinguished guests ate their way through the usual 7 or 8 courses. There was little conversation, and what there was of it was restrained. Few of the bankers and brokers had met Schwab, whose career had flowered along the banks of the Monongahela, and none knew him well. But before the evening was over, they and with them Money Master Morgan were to be swept off their feet, and a $1 billion baby, the United States Steel Corporation, was to be conceived. It is perhaps unfortunate for the sake of history that no record of Charlie Schwab's speech at the dinner was ever made. He repeated some parts of it at a later date during a similar meeting of Chicago bankers, and still later, when the government brought suit to dissolve the Steel Trust, he gave his own version from the witness stand of the remarks that stimulated Morgan into a frenzy of financial activity. It is probable, however, that it was a homely speech, somewhat ungrammatical, for the niceties of language never bothered Schwab, full of epigram and threaded with wit. But aside from that, it had a galvanic force and effect upon the $5 billion of estimated capital that were represented by the diners. After it was over and the gathering was still under its spell, although Schwab had talked for 90 minutes, Morgan led the orator to a recessed window where, dangling their legs from the high, uncomfortable seat, they talked for an hour more. The magic of the Schwab personality had been turned on full force. But what was more important and lasting was the full-fledged, clear-cut program he laid down for the aggrandizement of steel. Many other men had tried to interest Morgan in slapping together a steel trust after the pattern of the biscuit, wire, and hoop, sugar, rubber, whiskey, oil, or chewing gum combinations. John W. Gates, the gambler, had urged it, but Morgan distrusted him. The Moore boys, Bill and Jim, Chicago stock jobbers who had glued together a match trust and a cracker corporation, had urged it and failed. Albert H. Gary, the sanctimonious country lawyer, wanted to foster it, but he wasn't big enough to be impressive. Until Schwab's eloquence took J.P. Morgan to the heights, from which he could visualize the solid results of the most daring financial undertaking ever conceived, the project was regarded as a delirious dream of easy money crackpots. The financial financial magnetism that began a generation ago to attract thousands of small and sometimes inefficiently managed companies into large and competition-crushing combinations had become operative in the steel world through the devices of that jovial business pirate, John W. Gates. Gates already had formed the American Steel and Wire Company out of a chain of small concerns, and together with Morgan, had created the Federal Steel Company. The National Tube and American Bridge Companies were two more Morgan concerns, and the Moore brothers had forsaken the match and cookie business to form the American Group, Tin Plate, Steel Hoop, Steel Sheet, and the National Steel Company. But by the side of Andrew Carnegie's gigantic vertical trust, a trust owned and operated by 53 partners, those other combinations were picayune. They might combine to their heart's content, but the whole lot of them couldn't make a dent in the Carnegie organization, and Morgan knew it. The eccentric old Scott knew it too. From the heights of Skiboo Castle, he had viewed, first with amusement and then with resentment, the attempts of Morgan's smaller companies to cut into his business. When the attempts became too bold, Carnegie's temper was translated into anger and retaliation. He decided to duplicate every mill owned by his rivals. Hitherto, he hadn't been interested in wire, pipe, hoops, or sheet. Instead, he was content to sell such companies the raw steel and let them work it into whatever shape they wanted. Now, with Schwab as his chief and able lieutenant, he planned to drive his enemies to the wall. So it was that in the speech of Charles M. Schwab, Morgan saw the answer to his problem of combination. A trust without Carnegie, giant of them all, would be no trust at all. A plum pudding, as one writer said, without the plums. Schwab's speech on the night of December 12, 1900, undoubtedly carried the inference, though not the pledge, that the vast Carnegie enterprise could be brought under the Morgan tent. He talked of the world future for steel, of reorganization for efficiency, of specialization, of the scrapping of unsuccessful mills and concentration of effort on the flourishing properties, of economies in the ore traffic, of economies in overhead and administrative departments, of capturing foreign markets. More than that, he told the buccaneers among them wherein lay the errors of their customary piracy. Their purposes, he inferred, had been to create monopolies, raise prices, and pay themselves fat dividends out of privilege. Schwab condemned the system in his heartiest manner. The short-sightedness of such a policy, he told his hearers, lay in the fact that it restricted the market in an era when everything cried for expansion. By cheapening the cost of steel, he argued, an ever-expanding market would be created. More uses for steel would be devised, and a goodly portion of the world trade could be captured. Actually, though, he did not know it, Schwab was an apostle of modern mass production. So the dinner at the University Club came to an end. Morgan went home to think about Schwab's rosy predictions. Schwab went back to Pittsburgh to run the steel business for Wee Andrew Carnegie, while Gary and the rest went back to their stock tickers to fiddle around in anticipation of the next move. It was not long coming. It took Morgan about 1 week to digest the feast of reason Schwab had placed before him. When he had assured himself that no financial indigestion was to result, he sent for Schwab and found that young man rather coy. Mr. Carnegie, Schwab indicated, might not like it if he found his trusted company president had been flirting with the Emperor of Wall Street, the street upon which Carnegie was resolved never to tread. Then it was suggested by John W. Gates, the go-between, that if Schwab happened to be in the Bellevue Hotel in Philadelphia, J.P. Morgan might also happen to be there. When Schwab arrived, however, Morgan was inconveniently ill at his New York home, and so, on the elderman's pressing invitation, Schwab went to New York and presented himself at the door of the financier's library. Now, certain economic historians have professed the belief that from the beginning to the end of the drama, the stage was set by Andrew Carnegie, that the dinner to Schwab, the famous speech, the Sunday night conference between Schwab and the Money King were events arranged by the canny Scott. The truth is exactly the opposite. When Schwab was called in to consummate the deal, he didn't even know whether the little boss, as Andrew was called, would so much as listen to an offer to sell, particularly to a group of men whom Andrew regarded as being endowed with something less than holiness. But But Schwab did take into the conference with him, in his own handwriting, six sheets of copper plate figures representing, to his mind, the physical worth and the potential earning capacity of every steel company he regarded as an essential star in the new metal firmament. Four men pondered over these figures all night. The chief, of course, was Morgan, steadfast in his belief in the divine right of money. With him was his aristocratic partner, Robert Bacon, a scholar and a gentleman. The third was John W. Gates, whom Morgan scorned as a gambler and used as a tool. The fourth was Schwab, who knew more about the processes of making and selling steel than any whole group of men then living. Throughout that conference, the Pittsburghers' figures were never questioned. If he said a company was worth so much, then it was worth that much and no more. He was insistent, too, upon including in the combination only those concerns he nominated. He had conceived a corporation in which there would be no duplication, not even to satisfy the greed of friends who wanted to unload their companies upon the broad Morgan shoulders. Thus, he left out, by design, a number of the larger concerns upon which the walruses and carpenters of Wall Street had cast hungry eyes. When dawn came, Morgan rose and straightened his back. Only one question remained. "Do you think you can persuade Andrew Carnegie to sell?" he asked. "I can try," said Schwab. "If you can get him to sell, I will undertake the matter," said Morgan. "So far, so good. But would Carnegie sell? How much would he demand?" Schwab thought. "About $320 million. What would he take payment in? Common or preferred stocks, bonds, cash? Nobody could raise a third of $1 billion in cash." There was a golf game in January on the frost-cracking heath of St. Andrew's Links in Westchester, with Andrew bundled up in sweaters against the cold and Charlie talking volubly, as usual, to keep his spirits up. But no word of business was mentioned until the pair sat down in the cozy warmth of the Carnegie Cottage hard by. Then, with the same persuasiveness that had hypnotized 80 millionaires at the University Club, Schwab poured out the glittering promises of retirement and comfort, of untold millions to satisfy the old man's social caprices. Carnegie capitulated, wrote a figure on a slip of paper, handed it to Schwab, and said, "All right, that's what we'll sell for." The figure was approximately $400 million and was reached by taking the $320 million mentioned by Schwab as a basic figure and adding to it $80 million to represent the increased capital value over the previous 2 years. Later, on the deck of a transatlantic liner, the Scotsman said ruefully to Morgan, "I wish I had asked you for $100 million more." "If you had asked for it, you'd have gotten it," Morgan told him cheerfully. There was an uproar, of course. A British correspondent cabled that the foreign steel world was appalled by the gigantic combination. President Hadley of Yale declared that unless trusts were regulated, the country might expect an emperor in Washington within the next 25 years. But that able stock manipulator Keane went to his work of shoving the new stock at the public so vigorously that all the excess water, estimated by some at nearly $600 million, was absorbed in a twinkling. So Carnegie had his millions, and the Morgan Syndicate had $62 million for all its trouble, and all the boys from Gates and Gary had their millions. The 38-year-old Schwab had his reward. He was made president of the new corporation and remained in control until 1930. The dramatic story of big business, which you have just finished, was included in this book because it is a perfect illustration of the method by which desire can be transmuted into its physical equivalent. I imagine some readers will question the statement that a mere intangible desire can be converted into its physical equivalent. Doubtless, some will say, you cannot convert nothing into something. The answer is in the story of United States Steel. That giant organization was created in the mind of one man. The plan by which the organization was provided with the steel mills that gave it its financial stability was created in the mind of the same man. His faith, his desire, his imagination, his persistence were the real ingredients that went into United States Steel. The steel mills and mechanical equipment acquired by the corporation after it had been brought into legal existence were incidental. but careful analysis will disclose the fact that the appraised value of the properties acquired by the corporation increased in value by an estimated $600 million by the mere transaction which consolidated them under one management. In other words, Charles M. Schwab's idea plus the faith with which he conveyed it to the minds of J.P. Morgan and the others was marketed for a profit of approximately $600 million, not an insignificant sum for a single idea. What happened to some of the men who took their share of the millions of dollars of profit made by this transaction is a matter with which we are not now concerned. The important feature of the astounding achievement is that it serves as unquestionable evidence of the soundness of the philosophy described in this book, because this philosophy was the warp and the woof of the entire transaction. Moreover, the practicability of the philosophy has been tested by the fact that the United States Steel Corporation prospered and became one of the richest and most powerful corporations in America, employing thousands of people, developing new uses for steel, and opening new markets, thus proving that the $600 million in profit which the Schwab idea produced was earned. Riches begin in the form of thought. The amount is limited only by the person in whose mind the thought is put into motion. Faith removes limitations. Remember this when you are ready to bargain with life for whatever it is that you ask as your price for having passed this way. Remember also that the man who created the United States Steel Corporation was practically unknown at the time. He was merely Andrew Carnegie's Man Friday until he gave birth to his famous idea. After that, he quickly rose to a position of power, fame, and riches. There are no limitations to the mind except those we acknowledge. Both poverty and riches are the offspring of thought. So my friends, let's jump straight away into the mastermind portion of the call. Keep in mind this is not a company-specific call, so please no mention of company names, system names, leader names, unless the leaders are part of our community, and brevity and relevance always appreciated in your comments. One moment, please. Star 6, who's first? Come on out.
Bill Moist.
Hey, good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, family. I love this story, you know, because it really tells us that we're all capable of way more than we can imagine, you know. But what I want to bring up today is I had a realization this morning that there's a hidden benefit that we all receive by studying this material day after day after day. Would you like to know what it is, Paul?
I would love to know what it is.
Okay, I got two stories to illustrate this. One, a number of months ago, when we were reading, I think it was in Think, Grow Rich, and Hill made Christopher Columbus sound like he was a hero. You know, he was a great discoverer and all those kind of things. And then someone else called in and said that they thought that he was really a criminal. And both those things didn't seem right to me. So I did a little looking, and it reminded me that actually, he never discovered North America. He discovered the West Indies, which is Cuba and Haiti and some of those islands, and he was looking for spice. He wasn't a criminal. He was looking for spice because the spice routes got cut off. In fact, Erik Erikson discovered North America, Newfoundland, about 70 years before that. And about 1,000 years before that, the Chinese discovered the west coast of America. And some 400 years or 600 years before that, the Jewish contingent discovered America. And, of course, you know, hundreds of years, probably thousands of years before that, of course, the Native Americans who came over the land bridge discovered America. So you know, he was in kind of a sea of people who discovered this part of the world. So none of those positions really were very correct. And the second story is about, we have a journalist here who displays this every day. He does incredible research on projects, on subjects. He's on a TV, radio, newspaper. He's got a website called Inside Automotive where he reveals all kinds of things. But anyway, so the story was, and I never heard this in school, maybe you did, Paul, that before World War I, the Great War, started, Germany actually attacked the United States. They had some 700 terrorist attacks against the United States when we were still a neutral country. In fact, they blew up bridges and all kinds of facilities, but the government covered it up. They said, well, those were, you know, job-related violence or whatever they called it, but they covered it up. But after World War One, there was a tribunal in Germany where they would agree to pay back those restitution to America. And there was one man who was discovered to be the ringleader who would recruit people to attack America. So that's a story that we never heard. I never heard that. Maybe you did. So the hidden benefit, and the reason I bring those two stories out, there's a hidden benefit that we all get from studies material, and that hidden benefit is critical thinking, something that's not taught in our schools, but it's something that he teaches us by continuing to dig deeper, you know, to go deeper than what your current understanding is. And so, you know, I think it's so wonderful that we all can develop critical thinking by our study of this material. So anyway, you all have a great day, and back to you, Paul.
Bill, I love that hidden benefit, and isn't it also an application of the law of success, accurate thinking, which he exhorts us to follow in the book Law of Success. I love it. Thank you, Bill.
Very much.
And agree with you 100%. Awesome story. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Star 6, who's next? Come on out. Don't believe everything you hear, right? Star 6, who's next? Thoughts, comments, stories, insights. Come on out. Love to hear from you guys.
What's right, Rick?
Park.
All right, I got Coach Ray, and then I think Jesse's after that.
I think we got Jesse, then Coach Ray Briggs. You can go ahead.
Thank you so much. Real quick, a couple of things. In response to your initial conversation about journaling, I just want to say I'll take on the challenge because it is something that I have to agree I don't do enough of. I know how valuable it is because when I have done it, it is amazing what I pull out of my mind and put it on paper and say, wow, who wrote that? And I encourage everyone, as you did, to do it because it truly is amazing what we can pull from our mind and put on paper and really map it out. And it comes so naturally and flows when you start doing it, and you cannot believe what you have inside you. And I think that's something that we all should be challenged at going ahead and doing and finding the time. I always find excuses and don't have the time or this, that, and the other, and I'm sure we all can relate, but I just wanted to come out and say, number one, I absolutely will take on that challenge because I know how valuable it is. And two, the accurate thinking, it's so interesting. You know, one other person may have been given lots of credit for discovering America with the Vikings. And the thing I think about accurate thinking is that before we judge, before we go and make a point fingers, let's first get all the facts. And it's so easy to just take it on face value. And this is really something that I have taken and really realized that we really need to dig a little deeper and get both sides of the story on any type of an argument or any type of a disagreement we see or hear, because there usually are and definitely are two sides of the story. So that was my share. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Awesome thoughts, Jesse. And thanks for taking the challenge. I'm excited about that. Good stuff. Coach Ray, go ahead, sir.
Hi, good morning. Real quick, just had to jump out. Not so much that I have to share a ton of insight, but just kind of a little confirmation to this information I was talking about as far as accurate thinking, as far as, just having the ability to create something in your mind that you want to experience. And this is something that I experienced about a week ago that kind of came to light. And, not to get too far in the backdrop, but I'm originally from Leavenworth, Kansas, which is pretty much known for the federal penitentiary. There's like four or five correctional facilities all within, you know, the town that I grew up in. You know, so there's a certain mindset that has kind of existed in that community as far as, you know, what was possible or, you know, what you could achieve or what you could attain and stuff like that. And just fast forward, you know, I was blessed enough to kind of, you know, get some scholarships and play basketball and just things like that. And now I'm married, I'm in San Antonio and stuff like that. And one thing that used to cross my mind when I was younger was when I had a family, you know, I wanted to give my kids the best education opportunities possible. And after spending some time kind of doing some substitute teaching in the public school, the private school, et cetera, and stuff, this was before I even had kids. I already had my mind. I was like, man, you know, I would love for my child to have an opportunity to go to a private school. Just because just for where I'm at here in the city, you know, I saw the vast difference in the two. And, you know, just kind of growing up in the environment that I grew in, and anytime you hear a private school, you have a certain stigma of what you think that kind of kid is or how much money you got to make and stuff like that or be able to pay for that. So I had no idea how this was going to happen. This was before I had kids. So fast forward, my son is 5 years old now. And 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, he there's a private school here in San Antonio that I was coaching basketball at. And I had no thoughts about, you know, I was like, this school costs $10,000 a year to go to school to. And long story short, 2 weeks ago, he was awarded a grant and some things worked out towards some stuff we was able to do financially at home to where my son is actually in a private school and was blessed to have that opportunity. And it was just such a surreal moment. And that's what kind of what I wanted to share was, you know, sometimes when you have these thoughts or these ideas or, you know, create these million opportunities in your mind, you know, that feeling that exists when it actually happens. And I was actually able to experience that feeling and just that surreal moment when me and my wife was like, man, it's crazy to think that, you know, 6-7 years ago we were talking about this, but we had no idea how we was going to be able to do that. And to see it to come to fruition, that feeling and that emotion, you know what I'm saying, is something that's going to carry me for a lifetime in anything that I'm going to try and create or anything I want to do personally or in business. So, you know, we talk a lot about thinking, seeing yourself already there in that moment, but don't forget to create that emotion, you know what I'm saying? Really try to find that emotion that you're going to feel when you do accomplish that goal or create that thought that's going to open up opportunities for you in the future, because that just gives so much life to what you do moving forward. So hopefully that made a little bit of sense, but it's something that's got me pumped up and jacked up for the last 2 weeks, and my son's on his way to be smarter than me, so I'm pretty excited about it. Back to you, Paul.
Congratulations, Coach Ray. That's awesome. So cool.
Hey Paul. Larry Coach.
Hey, Larry.
Good morning. Good morning, family. You know, picking up a little bit on what Coach Ray was just saying, I think that as he was talking about having the emotion and all that, I think that's a really good distinction between having a desire for something and having a burning desire for something. It's that emotion that just engulfs you that makes that distinction between a burning desire and a desire. The other thing, the main thing that I wanted to comment on was what I find interesting about this story is that, you know, we think of Charles M. Schwab today as an investment company, and they have the motto, when Charles M. Schwab speaks, people listen. And I don't know if you remember that, but they even had like a large ad campaign probably a year and a half ago or so that used to capitalize upon that that saying. And it's really when you realize and you listen to the story that it highlights how important it was that when Charles M. Schwab spoke to these 80 plus millionaires, multimillionaires in the university club, that the people really did listen, despite the fact he was told to only speak for 20 minutes or less because they didn't want to be boring these people. And yet they were able to then have Pierpont Morgan sitting on the windowsill with him, listening and talking for another hour beyond that. So it's that Charles M. Schwab, who most people probably don't even know were involved in the steel business, that when he took his full ideas and put them into a plan and had all the facts and figures behind him about this burning desire that he had, that the people were listening. So it wasn't just a haphazard speech he threw out. It happened to be built upon a strong, solid foundation. So that's a good motivation for us. If we want people to listen, we really need to do our homework, and we really need to be prepared. And we're going to do that if we have a burning desire for what we're trying to do. Back to you, Paul.
I love it. So that is fascinating. I'd never noticed that before. Larry, thanks for pointing that out. Star 6, come on out. Anyone notice anything else in today's call? Reading.
Mr. Paul Titan Hutchins.
Oh, hey, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning. Morning, Paul. Think you grow rich, fam. I'm so glad I'm on this call. You know, you were reading this morning. I've read it countless times. I got to thinking. I know we don't talk about politics on this call, but there was a guy in politics that made a statement that I just totally disagree with. And I'll just say the statement that he made was, you didn't build that. And the reason I thought about that this morning is because I truly believe that capitalism is the greatest system in the world. And it really just tells you and it shows us really through desire and initiative and action that probably one of the most powerful sentences in all of capitalism is, I will help you build your business. And the reason I think I will help you build your business is so powerful is because America is a land of opportunity, not only a land of opportunity, but it is the land of help. If you build your business, I will help you if you build your business. And if you build your business, I will help you. The reason that is so powerful is that it's up to you to build your business. And the mentor that we're reading about in this book, if this guy did not take that sentence, if you build your business, I will help you, whatever that you is, you putting that your name into whatever, if it's Chris, you build your business, the people who could potentially help, if you don't build your business, they don't have a job. And they cannot mentor you, and it's not their responsibility to mentor me. If I will help you if you build your business. If Chris, who is you, who is me, if Chris doesn't build his business, I am not supposed to get help. But at the end of the day, I am the one that builds it because I am the one that shows the initiative. Just like I said a couple of weeks ago how there was a phrase in the movie that's very, very powerful as well, where Kevin Costner, he's laying in bed, he keeps hearing these voices. If you build it, they will come. If you build it, they will come. Well, he had to build it first before what I'm trying to say. He had to build it first before the mentors and the old timers and the greats came to help to take him to a level that is bigger than where he possibly would have gone by himself. But he has to build it. So you have to build it. But I think that's very important as we read this chapter, because we have to show the initiative and we have to build it. So many of us believe that, for example, whatever kind of business you're in, Paul, I'm pretty sure you're in an internet business, MLM business. A lot of people think that it's your responsibility to build their business. No, it is your responsibility to help them build if they build their own business, because they are responsible for their own lives. But I just really wanted to put that out there. That was one of the things I was thinking about as we were going through this chapter. Back to you, Paul.
Triple amen and a hallelujah for that, Chris. I appreciate those thoughts. So good, man. So good. Appreciate you so much. Thank you. Star 6 is next. Come on out.
Paz Simpson.
Hey, what's going on, Mr. Happiness Engineer? You going to make a smile today?
Oh, I hope so. Paul, how are you today?
Excellent. How about yourself?
I'm always so blessed and highly favored. Oh, man. Just coming in behind Chris is really... That was what he said was all so profound. What you want out of life is only going to happen when you actually take real action. The other night I couldn't sleep, and it was pretty funny. I tried to pretend like I was going to go to sleep, and I laid there for about 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes, tossing and turning, and then my mind said, get up and do something. So I started sending out some emails, you know, to some of the leaders that I know about my book that's about to be released. You know, and when I got up the next morning, I talked to my partner, Will, and I said, hey, I couldn't sleep all night. Like, I took about a 20-minute nap before the Think and Grow Rich call, you know, and I'm like, and I've been back at you. He's like, what happened? I said, something told me to build my business. You know, and it's one of those things, when you build your business, and because your business, like Zig Ziglar says, is just an extension of yourself. So as you're building yourself, and you're explaining to the world what you need more of who you are and showing the world more of who you are, then the world will actually be more in tune to actually help you out. You know, no one wants to help somebody that's not helping themselves. Nobody wants to be a part of something that's not moving forward. No one gets on a train that's actually standing still. But if they know the train has a next stop, they're going to be real amped to jump on it so that they can get to their destination. So I tell everyone on the call, Don't stand still. Even if you fail and you fall, fall forward. You can fall forward a million times. I bump my head a million times. And I get up and I laugh because it's not how many times you fall. It's how many times you get up. Because no one remembers your last failure as long as you succeed. So I've failed a million times, and the only thing that people talk to me about are the success stories. So I tell you about my failures so that someone else who hasn't succeeded can fail and feel good about it. So fail today, and then tomorrow succeed. That's my thing. Enjoy the day, and know that today is Wednesday's worth. Your dream is only as worthless or as worth what you put into it. So cut off the television and build your vision. Love you guys.
I love it. Thank you, Pass. Awesome stuff, man. Awesome stuff. Star 6 is next. Come on out.
Mario out of New York.
Hey, Mario. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning. Yeah, just a quick two little stories. One was my father's a very good chess player, and he used to teach me how to play. And you know what? I disliked losing. I really did. So I got to the point where I even went on to the New York Times and played the game, the white pieces and the black pieces myself. And I learned to learn. And eventually I was able to crush them, which was, you know, exciting. And the other one I bring up is the idea of playing baseball. I could never hit a curveball when I first went through the majors. And, you know, I had a coach, and he guided me. Now, obviously, individually, you have to, you and only you, it's what I tell people when you get into any business, it's you and only you can create it and succeed in it. I could be the only one who could hit the curveball for myself, obviously, and it's the same thing. And that's what, you know, the gentleman before us has talked about in prior people. You know, again, you have to take responsibility. We can teach you as a group how to succeed, but ultimately you have to take the steps to do it yourself. If not, you know, you're never going to be able to be as successful as you were put on this earth to do.
Powerful thoughts, Mario. Thank you for that, man. Well said. Star 6 is next. Come on out. We've got 4 minutes left. Would love to hear from you this morning.
This is Nancy here, Paul. How you doing?
Hey, good morning, Nancy. Good to hear you.
Oh, thank you, Think and Grow Rich family. Just a couple of thoughts as I'm listening along to the steel corporations growing and that story this morning. It makes me think of the founder of our company and all of the vehicles that help us to have the same kind of vision that we want for ourselves. In this call, Think and Grow Rich family call is like a tool. It's something that we use on a daily basis as we grow in ourselves and our thoughts, and we recite our major definite purpose to ourselves every day. I mean, that vision he reminds me of, our founder, is the Steel Corporation and how it developed in that particular meeting that they had. And we're like that. This company and these calls are tools that we are able to grow as individuals with new thoughts and new things that we write down in the journaling, which I'm going to take that up too. I have a perfect book downstairs that I haven't even written anything in years, and I already have it. So taking the steps and being active to build my business, as the other person, I forget his name, I apologize, but I just can't say enough about this call and the things that are happening in my life and where I'm allowing myself to be successful and not setting up roadblocks. So thanks a bunch, family and Paul, this morning for letting me come out.
Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate you sharing that and believing in yourself, my friend. Hey, good morning, Action Jackson.
Yes, that was great information from Nancy, and it got me to thinking about the journaling aspect of it. I think I've said this before, but you know, not the things that's new, but some things you need to be reminded of is the fact of we all are sharp-minded individuals, and the thing that says the sharpest of minds cannot outlast the dullest of ink. The sharpest of minds cannot outlast the dullest of ink. It's amazing that when you start journaling and writing things down, a year from now, even you can do it a quarterly or a semi-annually, go back and review it, and you will see the evidence of growth in your business, in yourself, or the lack thereof. So keep that in mind as far as writing things down. I used to say that I go back to my mom's home, and I look at my old love letters I was writing back in the 7th and 8th grade, and I was like, man, I can't believe I was writing that back in 7th and 8th grade, you know. And I had just totally forgotten it. But at the same time, you know, it brings back, the remembrance of it, and you say, wow, you know, and just looking at the growth of what you write even a year ago. So the sharpest of mind cannot outlast the dullest of ink. Back to you, Paul.
I love that, Patrick. Action Jackson. And hey, guys, we're at time, so let's get out there and make it a fantastic day. Who has the power to make it that way? I do. You do. We all do. So let's make it so. We'll see you back here tomorrow morning.
Hey there, my friend. This is Paul Hutchings. I want to thank you sincerely for listening to this week's edition of the Think and Grow Rich Call podcast. For more information on our community, to learn how you can listen to these calls daily and get the full panorama of all of the content and daily motivation and inspiration that we engage in, and to learn how you can connect with other like-minded entrepreneurs like yourself, feel free to visit our website, our home on the web at www.growrichaudios.com. Again, that's growrichaudios.com. And if you'd like to connect with me, feel free to visit my website, pipelinemoney.com. Again, that's www.pipelinemoney.com. Again, thanks for listening, and whatever you do, never give up on your dreams. Take care, and bye for now.
You make my day every day.
Thank you, family. Have a great day.
Stay positive and keep fighting.
Get that journal.
Never give up.